Welcome to another episode of Growing Forward, a collaborative podcast between New Mexico Political Report and New Mexico PBS, where we look at cannabis in New Mexico. I'm Megan Kamrick, a New Mexico PBS correspondent and on-air host with KUNM. I'm joined by my co-host, Andy Lyman, with New Mexico Political Report. And today we are doing this Facebook Live we call Ask Me Anything to ask the superintendent of the Regulation and Licensing Department and former lawmaker Linda Trujillo, because her department is really the one tasked with implementing the regulations now that we have legalized cannabis. And we're also joined by Kim Chavez Cook, the lead appellate attorney for the New Mexico Law Offices of the Public Defender, because of course, along with cannabis legalization bill, there was a bill for expungement of some past marijuana offenses. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us on.
Let's start with some very basic things. Ms. Trujillo, Superintendent Trujillo, when does cannabis officially become legal in New Mexico? And when it becomes legal, where can you consume it?
So that's a really good question. As all lawyers will say, it depends. And it really does depend. However, June 29th is the day that this legislation becomes effective. And so under the legislation, the possession of cannabis up to certain amounts becomes legal. The sale of commercial, or what would be outside of medical cannabis, does not become, won't happen in New Mexico for quite some time. So the department is tasked with setting a date for when we're ready to start selling commercial cannabis. And our deadline is no later than April 1st. Our goal is to try to get that accomplished before that. I know there was a lot of questions about, why can't we just sell it now? Why do you need to have longer than till January? There's a lot of moving pieces that we're taking care of literally every day. And every day there's something new that's happening that we're trying to, kind of work through. And so we hope that we'll be able to do it before April 1st, but that is our ultimate deadline.
And we should make it clear, it's legal as of June 29th, but that doesn't mean that you can just walk down Central Avenue and roll a joint and smoke it outside, right?
Yeah, no, the smoking of cannabis is not going to be legal in public places. So you're not going to be able to walk down the street. You're not going to be able to go to a park. You're not going to be able to go to, you know, some place that is public, the grocery store. If you think about, like, where can you smoke? We don't smoke in many of those public places, right? But cannabis is not going to be, you cannot smoke it in those public places.
Superintendent, along those lines, as far as, you know, this is sort of, and a lot of states have seen this too, we have this sort of weird area between legalization and setting up all this stuff. But after the 29th, I'm assuming the home grow and possession goes into effect, right? So that if you could have up to 6 plants in your domicile, I guess you could say, and you can't sell what you grow. We know that because you have to have a license. Can you gift those things? Because currently under the medical program, patients can gift cannabis to each other. Is that going to be allowed?
That's a really good clarification, Andy. Thank you for bringing that up. Yes, effective June 29th, it will be legal, authorized for individual to grow up to 6 cannabis plants in their home and up to 12 per household. So if you have more than one person that's 21 or older, you could have up to 12. But it's important too to keep in mind that there are protections for property owners. And so if you're not the property owner, you probably should check with your whoever is the property owner and make sure that that's going to be okay. So it's not a legal definition. It's more of a civil. So is it going to be okay with the person that owns the property that you're residing at? So yes, and you can gift it, but there can't be any compensation for it. So you can give away up to a certain amount, but there cannot be any compensation for that.
And just reminded me of the landlord question, Andy. So good point about growing it on land you don't own, but what if you are a tenant and you wish to use cannabis and your landlord is not okay with that?
there's multiple ways of using cannabis. And I think in our minds, we kind of always default back to the smoking, and that's not the only way to consume cannabis. So really what the law is looking at addressing is the smoking of cannabis. And so again, if you've got a apartment complex, let's say you're living in an apartment complex that does not allow smoking inside your apartment, or you have to pay an extra fee for that, I think it would behoove you to check with your whoever is the property owner to find out whether or not is there an extra fee if I smoke cannabis in here, or if it's prohibited, obviously you'll still be prohibited from smoking. But those are things that you should ask the person who you're renting the property from.
And just to be clear, under the current medical program, there's a special license to grow your own, and you have to get approval from your landlord and all that other stuff. In this case, everyone, as long as you're 21, is allowed to grow your own. Is that correct?
That is correct. That is correct. The licensing requirement to be able to grow your own has been eliminated from statute because it didn't make sense to keep a license requirement for medical cannabis when you don't have to have a license if you're not doing medical cannabis. Why would anybody attempt to get a license if it's not necessary? So we eliminated that. There does seem to be a little bit of a gap right now that we're trying to figure out. And that is that medical cannabis patients between the age of 18 and 20 have been granted authority to grow cannabis. That's not considered in the legislation. And we quite honestly haven't come up with a solution for that yet. But we've got some time, so nobody panic yet.
Someone had a question, I think, just going to where you can consume. I know the idea is to have consumption areas and lounges, but what if you're on a patio in a bar that allows smoking cigarettes? Can you smoke cannabis there?
So that's really a good question, Megan. And the answer is going to be no, because you are not going to be able to purchase and consume cannabis or alcohol in the same area. Cannabis is not going to be available at bars, and alcohol is not going to be available in consumption areas. Those two things are strictly prohibited from being combined.
To transition a little bit, Kim, can we talk just briefly about expungement? We talked kind of before we went live on how this is supposed to work. We've seen a lot of different numbers, and we talked earlier about how the numbers are the people that will be impacted by this. We don't quite know all the specifics, but can you tell us generally how it's supposed to work? People that are maybe have a record, that expungement, how that's supposed to work under the law?
Sure. And I think the reason that the numbers are sort of all over the map is because there's a different way to sort of categorize who's going to be affected. I think the widest net to cast is who in the history of ever has had a marijuana related conviction or arrest, because all of those are implicated by this expungement law. But of course, some of those folks, is looking back pretty far. Some of those folks may have passed away, may have moved out of state, may have done something that is still considered a crime even under the new law, because it's important for people to also know that there are restrictions on the legalization of cannabis under this new law. It's not a free for all, as you know, was mentioned. There's a limit on the number of plants that can be grown. There's also a limit on the number of ounces that can be possessed of harvested cannabis. So there are still crimes that could be considered still a crime under the new law. So parsing that out is going to be part of the process. And the way that will work is it's designed to be automatic so that individual people don't have to become legal experts overnight and figure out how to make this happen for themselves. It's going to start in the context of people who are still serving a sentence, where it's recent enough that they're still under the sentence for one of those kinds of convictions. The 30 days from the effective date, which again is June 29th, will be corrections department and jails will have those 30 days. Hopefully they're getting a head start now to communicate to the courts all of the people who they are currently holding incarcerated on a cannabis related conviction. And the court will then have to reopen those cases automatically, dismiss convictions that are now not crimes under the new law, and expunge those convictions. And that will be a process that goes through the Department of Public Safety. So that is one set of people. The other set of affected people are those who their sentence is already over. They've theoretically moved on with their lives, but they've got this record that might still be weighing them down in a variety of ways. And so the Department of Public Safety has until January 1st, a little bit longer because it's a longer list, to identify all of those people who have these past convictions that the law calls them eligible cases, to flag those. And then prosecutors have sort of the filter function of flagging any that, although they're identified as eligible, might not actually qualify. And those can be argued about in court, but anything that the prosecutors let through and say, yes, this clearly qualifies, are going to then be very fast-tracked through the court to have, again, those convictions vacated and expunged.
So I know that historically the public defender's office has been understaffed, underfunded, all those things. But yesterday we talked to the Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham, and she said she's deputizing pretty much everybody in the state to sort of keep on this. What sort of role is the public defender's office planning to take in this to sort of make sure things are going the way they're supposed to be?
Sure. I think a lot of it's left is as of yet undecided, because the law that the legislature adopted actually was amended to specifically remove our necessary involvement. Because if everything goes smoothly, we hopefully wouldn't have to do anything, right? So it's going to be a sort of wait and see. What it does, instead of designating the public defender department as being one of the parties automatically involved, they've served notice now, or the statute now requires notice to be served of the eligible people and the prosecutor's objections to defense counsel of record. So that would also actually mean that folks who had a private attorney, maybe when they originally had this case, that makes sure that they're looped in. But it also just has broader language to make sure that someone is looped in. And that way, if the prosecutor is objecting, but it is a case that should qualify, someone can step in. So we're going to kind of have to see how much of that happens. A lot of that will depend on, you know, how cautious prosecutors are being in their lodging of objections. And if it does become a bigger job than we can just sort of absorb into our regular workloads, we'll have to cross that bridge, and we might be having to like create a position or something like that. But that's all very hypothetical right now. And we're going to kind of have to see how it goes, frankly.
And a lot of people might have cannabis convictions or be in jail for that, but they have other things on the conviction. So what happens if that's a sort of a bundled situation?
Sure. It's actually very common because a lot of times people are being picked up on something else. And then just during the course of arresting them, they do a pat down and they say, what's that in your pocket? And so then, yeah, the possession count just sort of gets added on to something else that might have been happening. The bill that passed is actually very clear about that, to say that only the cannabis charge is going to be eligible for the expungement. So if a person has, for example, let's say DUI is going to be a pretty common one probably, because if someone was driving under the influence and still had some marijuana on them, the DUI conviction is not going to be reduced or dismissed or expunged under this situation, but the standalone possession charge that might have come with it would be. So if they had those two convictions run what we call consecutively, or stacked is sort of the lingo for it, where one sentence has to be fully served before you serve the next, getting rid of the cannabis conviction could actually serve to reduce someone's sentence at this point. But they may have had those two sentences run concurrently, so that that's one way in which a judge can sort of show leniency at sentencing, is to say, well, you've got these two sentences, but I'm going to let you serve them at the same time, so it doesn't actually increase the length. That person might not experience as much of a reduction in sentence from dismissing, vacating, and expunging the cannabis conviction. But it's was very important to the legislature to make sure that it didn't serve as a sort of hook for people to get an entire case dismissed if they had these other viable convictions that would still be criminal under current law.
And if you, as Superintendent Trujillo made clear, there's only certain area or certain places you can't just be on the street consuming smoking cannabis. So what happens in this situation? It's legal, but you're cited, you're not arrested necessarily, but what happens? You get a fine or?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I believe the bill did specify, and I would have to look to see what the actual violation level is, but it specifically said, you know, identifies a violation for consumption outside of a designated area. So that would be, I don't know if, I can't remember if it's like you get a ticket for that or if it's a misdemeanor. And I see the superintendent shaking her head as well. It's in there. I can look it up. And maybe we can post a follow-up on, I'll put a comment on the Facebook link or something like that. but it does have repercussions. It's not a freebie. It could be a fine or it could be a misdemeanor. I just don't recall which.
This is probably a good time to mention that we talked about home grows and stuff like that, and Superintendent Trujillo mentioned, you know, check with your landlord, all these things, and Kim, you mentioned fines and I guess penalties under the new law. Those are the things I think is probably important for people to know, that if you're under 21, you can't grow at home. If you're under 21, you can't possess at all. So all these things are new penalties and new things that go along with legalization.
Yeah. And in fact, some of them are felonies even. So it's definitely important to be informed about that. And I have a sort of bullet point list in front of me here. If you are growing more plants than you're allowed to, more mature plants, it can be up to a fourth degree felony depending on your age. And then unlicensed distribution, if you're not going to go through the RLD process and you think you can just start selling out of your garage, think again, that is going to be a misdemeanor every time you do it. It would be a felony if you put up a sign on your garage and held yourself out as being an establishment that was licensed, but you weren't. Possession in a school or a daycare, even if you could possess it anywhere else, is going to be a misdemeanor. And then possessing more than 2 ounces of cannabis flowers, as it's described in the statute, is also up to a fourth degree felony, depending on your age and the quantity that you possess. So there's all of these things that could still carry serious consequences. So you have to make sure that you're doing it within the bounds of the legalization.
I also have a question about buying and selling seeds.
Yeah, that's a great question. Seeds are not specified. I don't think that seeds are going to be regulated heavily. It's just going to be about the mature plants. So you can probably, and I'm seeing nodding head from the superintendent, so that's good. That was my interpretation of it. I'm no horticulturalist. It's my belief that you probably have to start a whole bunch of seeds to get 6 solid plants going. So
that's kind of what I've heard too, Kim. And yeah, the seeds are not regulated. It is in fact the mature plants that are regulated.
And remind us, is there a definition in the law what mature plant is?
So there's a definition of what immature plants are. And an immature plant would be a plant that is not showing any leaves. So once it begins to show leaves, it's not going to be defined as a mature plant, but it will be more than an immature plant. And I know that's a little shady there, but my understanding is that it does take a significant amount of seeds to actually get some mature plants. I've used the example, look, we can't all grow tomatoes. In fact, I haven't been really successful. It's cheaper for me to buy them in the store, but cannabis is not an easy plant to grow.
Probably is a lot like, people brewing their own beer or something like that too, right? It's easier just to go to the store and buy it than it is to go through the whole process of making it yourself.
Yep, that's what I've heard.
I wanted to make it clear too for people, if you go to the New Mexico Regulation and Licensing Department homepage, which is rld.state.nm.us, there's a giant red bar at the top that takes you to the Cannabis Control Division. That also has a lot of answers to questions people might have. People were asking about when can they start applying for licenses, Superintendent Trujillo.
Yeah, so that's kind of the question of the hour. In fact, it was the meeting I was on just before I signed into this one. And so we have a responsibility, just like the April deadline, you know, it's no later than, we have a requirement to have rules in place and have applications available for producers. That would be regular producers, micro business producers, vertically integrated producers and integrated producers, and legacy producers. So legacy producers would be, there's not really a definition of that, but the way that we've been terming it is producers that are currently licensed under the medical cannabis program. Those applications have to be available no later than September 1st. Anything else outside of that production, those applications have to be available no later than January 1st.
I want to ask a quick question about something that I think was in the news already, and if it's not something that you can answer now, I guess the question is, when should we expect an answer? But it has to do with the letter that came from the, I think, group of five medical producers that brought up the issue of, as of June 29th, do medical patients, are they still stuck to the 2 ounces every 90 days as it, in the previous law? I'm sorry, it was 8 ounces every 90 days. And then the new law says 2 ounces in every purchase. So if there's not an answer for that, when can patients or producers know what their possible new limits are after the 29th?
Let's be really clear on that. Regardless of the letter and any answer that might come as a result of that, there was a real delineation between RLD responsibilities and Department of Health responsibilities. Department of Health maintains a responsibility for the registry and anything that's attached to that. We purposefully took away the responsibility to be licensed for the same reason, for the growing personal production, because it was just really clear, like, who would do that, right? If you can do it without a license, why would you go and get a license? But the Department of Health maintains all authority for the registry and everything attached to that that's not moved over to RLD. That includes the ability to determine what is an adequate supply for a medical patient. Right now, the Department of Health has rules that define what is an adequate supply for a medical cannabis patient. That will remain with the Department of Health. We'll not be making a decision about adequate supply for medical patients. That function will remain with the Department of Health. And the benefit of that adequate supply is that it is tax-free, right? There will continue to be no taxes on medical cannabis, and the adequate supply will determine what the medical cannabis that you can purchase. That does not change. Anything beyond that adequate supply is going to be what we're terming as commercial cannabis buying, right? You've heard the adult use, we've heard recreational. Regardless of what you call it, we're calling it commercial. Commercial is not medical cannabis purchases. Commercial is defined in the act as that purchase that is outside of the medical cannabis purchase. That anything beyond what the department determines, the Department of Health determines as adequate supply, would be commercial cannabis. And that's not going to be legal to purchase until the department sets a date for it to be legal to purchase. And that is going to be no later than April 1st.
I just want to make sure there's not patients out there that are going to expect that they're going to be able to buy more and then go buy their 2 ounces. So just, they should not expect to buy any more than what's currently allowed.
Of that remains in place. All of the purchasing under the medical cannabis program remains the same until the Department of Health changes it, if they do. I haven't had that conversation with them about that particular issue and whether they're going to increase adequate supply, but that's totally going to be determined by the Department of Health and the experts that they have over there.
Kim, gave me a chat. Yeah, you said you have an answer for the smoking in public consequences.
I do. I also have a follow-up to this 2 ounce question, but just super quickly, smoking in public carries a $50 fine. So that's just simple answer there. As far as the 2 ounces go, I also wanted to clarify that it does allow, you're not allowed to possess more than, again, leaving the medical aside as the superintendent just described, the 2 ounce maximum is in sort of, I guess you could call it a usable area or space, like in your access place. There is, it does allow, especially if you're home growing, you might end up harvesting more than 2 ounces at the end of the season or however that works. You are allowed to have in your home elsewhere stored away your surplus, essentially, so long as it's out of public view. But it's the sort of immediate access area that the 2 ounces they'd be looking at for that limitation.
I think that's a really good point to raise. I think this came up during the session too, was you can actually go store to store to store and buy 2 ounces each time, but then you're now in violation of that possession amount. You'd have to go drop some off at home where you, because that's what the law says also, you can lock it up away from, I think public view is what it says, and then go
back. We did take out the lockup, Andy. I want to make that clear. I know it keeps coming up over and over again, but we decided, like, how are we going to enforce that? Yeah, I would love that it be locked up in a safe place if kids have access to it, but locking it up didn't seem like, it seemed like it was maybe a bridge too far. But so it does have to be out of sight, though, from the public.
Okay. A couple of people have asked about this. So we will not have retail sales here. It's legal as of June 29th, but you don't expect to just go walk into a dispensary unless you've got a medical card. So by no later than April 1st next year, we will have retail recreational sales. Can you go to Arizona or Colorado and buy it and bring it back?
So that's really a kind of a legal question that I really just can't answer. What I can say is that if you're in New Mexico and you have the legal amount that you can possess on June 29th or later, there's no violation of the law for that.
Okay. I think that is the safest answer. I can also say that, you know, whether a New Mexico law enforcement person would stop you at the border coming across from Arizona and consider you in violation in some way, I don't see anything specifically prohibiting that. There are limitations on the commercial sales, have it be sourced locally. But in terms of the possession, there's no inquiry in the statute about where you got it. And so I don't think that should be inherently illegal under New Mexico law. But let's not all forget that federal law still prohibits cannabis, and crossing state lines with something is going to invoke the authority of the feds. So probably safest bet is to not cross state lines with it.
And the bill does, in fact, address the idea of someone buying in another state and transporting it here for sale. So out-of-state producers will be prohibited until it becomes federally legal to import cannabis from another state and sell it once retail is allowed. That will remain illegal.
Point to bring up about the federal illegality. This came up on the KUNM show We Do No More Normal, Kim, you were on last week, when they talked to a couple of immigration attorneys. And I know you are not an immigration attorney, Kim, but it's good to remember that if you are in immigration status, undocumented, or even if you have a green card, you should be wary about being involved in cannabis in any way, especially if you're trying to get citizenship.
I think that's absolutely right, in part because you would still be subject to prosecution under federal law. I am fairly confident that under the current administration, it's a low priority to enforce federal cannabis laws in states that have legalized recreational use, but that doesn't mean that they can't. And it also doesn't mean that if you are, say, for example, in possession of more than 2 ounces and you get picked up for that and get a felony for that, that is absolutely going to have immigration consequences.
Yeah, it was interesting. They had stories of even people who had a green card working legally in cannabis in Colorado. Mm-hmm. It derailed their citizenship application.
Mm-hmm. Good to Superintendent, another quick question about, I guess, implementation. I think there's going to be a market study. I think you said that you're going to figure out what the appropriate amount for growers or producers to grow. Of course, that ends 2026, I believe. There was some concerns. It was one producer in particular didn't really believe that the studies that DOH did were accurate. But I think you had mentioned that you would also sort of mimic what DOH did. Can you talk a little bit about what that study might entail or what you might look at?
Yeah, no, thank you. So we're writing up a scope of work. We're working on what is the information that we need to have, and what we believe the law requires us to look at is what are the sales in other states where recreational adult use is authorized and or medical. We're really looking at the recreational adult use states specifically. There's, you know, most of them still have medical too, but nonetheless, we want to know what are the sales, what is the average cost of the cannabis, and what is their adult population? We'll kind of come up with a formula there is what we're hoping to do. I've said it before, I am not a mathematician, nor am I an economist. And so I have to think about it in terms that make sense to me. But basically, we're trying to look at supply and demand and then make some decisions about what's predicted to be supply and demand in New Mexico based upon what the supply and demand, particularly initially in other states, have been. And I know New Mexico is always a little bit different than everybody else, and so we take that into consideration. But that's what we're looking at, is what is the supply and demand in other states? We're gonna obviously look at what has been the supply and demand in New Mexico for the medical program, how big is the adult population, and who do we think is gonna purchase? What percentage of the adult population is gonna purchase? And so one of the things that we're also looking at doing as part of this study is doing a survey with a large population and asking questions about whether or not they would be interested in buying recreational cannabis. So the survey is going to be part of that analysis. I think it's going to be a pretty comprehensive analysis that we're looking at. And we are looking at, you know, what has there been concern about in the past that the reports that were done by the Department of Health felt untrustworthy to some? And we're hoping that we can address those issues as we move forward.
I would assume it would also be an ongoing thing, right? Once you start seeing sales, you can kind of reevaluate and reassess. Yes.
The law gives us that authority, Andy, is to look at if there's a shortage, then there's some steps that we can take, particularly if there's a shortage of medical cannabis. There are some really specific things that we can do. And in the very end, the most severe thing that we could do is to license producers and only allow them to produce medical cannabis.
I think in other states when they legalized, I don't know this for sure, but I seem to remember hearing that out-of-state folks had a certain limitation. Under this current law, if you were coming from, let's say, Texas, you could buy just as much as any resident here, right?
Yeah, that's correct. There's not any distinction between what you're going to have to prove is that you're 21. So you're not going to have to prove where you live. You're not going to have to give your name, your address. You're not going to have to do anything except for what we do when we go and buy a bottle of wine. You're going to have to prove your age.
Can I ask, there's a micro license under the act. You can grow up to 200 plants. How much will that license cost, and what can you do with the plants once you grow them under that license?
If you decide that you want to be a micro producer, and I should have those fees like on a chart for me, but the fee is significantly reduced. And there's one fee that's $1,000, another one that's $1,500. So in general, your fee is going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of half of what it would be if you were regular business, not going to grow more than 200 plants, a producer. If you're micro, though, you are limited to 200 plants. If you're a vertically integrated micro business, you could in fact be approved to be a producer, not more than 200 plants. You could be approved to be the manufacturer of those plants that you grow, and you could be approved to be the retailer of what you manufacture. You will only be allowed to have one retail site, though. That's the limitation on being a micro business, is that you're small. You're either going to be small and stay small, or you're looking for a way to grow your business in a responsible fashion. Those are the limitations for the micro business, and they will not be charged a per plant fee.
And what is the process of getting licensed? Is it a box checking exercise, a closer examination of an applicant's abilities? How much detail will go into those?
That is a really good question, Megan. And that's what we're figuring out right now. In fact, that's what we're meeting about and talking about and trying to figure out. I don't know that it's going to be a whole lot different than the process that you're currently required to go through for medical cannabis. Of course, there's some differences. You know, you're not going to have to be a nonprofit. There's not going to be restrictions on who can be on your board if you are a nonprofit. On the other hand, if you're a producer, you're not going to be able to be a manufacturer unless you get a manufacturer's license. So producers right now, is my understanding, are manufacturing, they're producing, and in many cases, they're selling. those are all kind of siloed into different buckets and licensing right. requirements now. And so those are kind of the things that we're sorting through. My staff, my leadership team, there's seven of us, are going to be, we're having a cannabis summit. We're coming together at the office. We're going to be socially distanced. We're going to take all the precautions that we need to take to keep ourselves away from each other. But we are literally going to be bringing out the whiteboard, the flip charts, and we're going to diagram this out. We've got a project manager that the Department of Health is loaning to us, and she's creating something called a smart sheet. Is a new concept to me, but Secretary Gruginski from the Early Ed Department was gracious enough to meet with me, and she gave me all of the tips that she had from creating the Early Ed Department, and the smart sheet was in fact one of the things that we're like, oh, that sounds really excellent. So we'll diagram out what the tasks are that we have to accomplish. You know, what is the period that they have to be accomplished and who's responsible for those tasks. And we will ultimately have a dashboard that we'll be able to look at and answer to that. Yep, we're doing great on this one. We might be in the yellow zone on this one. So it's kind of similar to the implementation of a IT project, if anybody's ever done that, where yeah. you've got like project development and you know who's responsible and you've got deadlines and you get that dashboard with the red, yellow, and green.
Because you have to promulgate regs by September, I believe, right? Because then there's to be public comment.
Yeah, that's probably one of the biggest things that I'm stressing about, which is why I'm really trying hard to bring the pieces together. So Department of Health is working on identifying in their current rules, based upon how we're going to be licensing, what do they see as the most important things? We're going to take those and we're going to go and meet with the Department of Agriculture and let them help us fill in the gaps for agriculture. We've already identified that there's one gap, and that is that there's no pesticide information that's listed. So we'll be filling in that gap. We'll meet with the state engineer and they'll help us fill in any gaps that we have on water rights and water usage. Meeting with the Department of Environment and they'll help us fill in any gaps that we're missing there. Once we kind of feel like we've got those gaps like filled, then we'll probably bring everybody back together again, including each one of those entities, and say, okay, this is what we combine together. Kind of similar to what you do with legislation. Let's everybody just like really dig in, take a look at it, and let's go through it line by line and see if we captured everything we need.
We had another question about when we were talking about growing and micro licenses. Will there be geographical limitations on growth? For instance, can you grow in the city limits, in private residence? How far from schools, daycare? These could be things that you're working on right now.
Yeah, actually the law prohibits cannabis within 300 feet of a daycare or a school. So those will remain very similar to the alcohol, right? We have those same kinds of requirements. That remains the same. In regards to geographical, there is no license limit in this law. That is not an authority that the department has, nor is it an authority that we necessarily want. We don't want to have to make decisions about who can and who can't. We'll have hopefully an online process that will be similar to getting licensed as a psychologist, right? We don't have a certain period of year that you can get licensed as a psychologist. That's an ongoing licensure process. So that model will be applied to cannabis. We'll get it so that you can go online. You can provide the information that you need. If there's additional supporting documents, we're hoping that we have a process whereby you can upload it. We'd like it to all be an online process. I can't guarantee that, but that's definitely one of those projects that's going to be on that smart sheet that's going to have a deadline to be before we start issuing licenses. Hopefully we'll get there.
There was was a lot of talk during the regular session and actually past few sessions about equity in the market and equitable opportunities. Is that something that's going to be worked out in rules, or can you talk about how that might work out? Like, if is there sort of prioritization of licenses, or what does that mean in practice?
So in practice, what that really means, and you know, there's some things that you can legislate and that you can write rules for, and there's other things that you just have to do. And the advisory committee is tasked with helping us to come up with best practice policies to make that happen. And the way that I kind of envision it is very similar. I used to work in microbusiness, right? Not cannabis, but just small entrepreneurs. That's what my first career here in New Mexico was, to travel around the state and work with small entrepreneurs. I see this in the same context. We have got to get out into the community. We have got to get out to the far reaches of New Mexico and make sure that this information gets to them. Being on a show like this, being live, having people ask questions and they get answers to those is part of our strategy, but it's just one part of the strategy. Believe you me, Andy, I have plenty to do. That being on Facebook Live, it's a commitment that we are making to try to get the word out. And so how do we get those individuals throughout the state that are from communities that have been negatively impacted from the war on drugs? We have to actually get out into those communities, and we have to get the message out to them in a way that they're going to hear the message.
And I think we do want to get you guys out by two, you two out by two, but I think Kim had something else to add about the equity piece.
Yeah, it's a perfect dovetail actually from what the superintendent was just saying, which is that similarly, another aspect of the what we're calling the expungement bill that was passed simultaneously, it does actually a little bit more than just expunge. It also includes employment and licensure protections for people with prior convictions. So it ensures that an expunged conviction cannot be used against you in state employment, and that prior convictions of any kind, frankly, not even limited to cannabis, unless they fall within a very specific list of offenses that a hiring agency deems directly relevant to the work and the employment involved for that agency, should not be a barrier to employment or professional licensure. And so I think that's also an important thing for people to know is happening, because there's probably a lot of folks out there who have tried to get licensed as, you know, a cosmetologist or whatever it is, and been turned away in the past. This might be a new opportunity to try those things going forward.
Yeah, we can't control private employers, or of course, federal employers or contractors for federal agencies, right?
Right. Those so might, state yeah. employment and licensure.
We had a question, and this again, Superintendent Trujillo, to be worked out, but will micro licensees have the same requirements as larger licensees as far as water rights requirements?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the water is something that we have to figure out. And that's why we'll be meeting with agriculture and with environment and with the state engineer, is because we have to learn, like, how much water does it really take to grow cannabis? And then how do we verify that someone has access to that water and that they're following their local Esequia rules, if that's where they're getting their water, that they have the legal right to use the water for that. I know even just here in the city of Santa Fe, you can't just open up a business and use up all of our water. There are some limitations. That's part of the local business licensing processes. How much resources are you going to use from the community? Can the community withstand that? So those are all kind of things that we'll be working out the details of. But those things are already in place, Megan, in most communities. You do not just get to open up a business without getting a business license. And with that business license comes some responsibilities to the community in regards to where your business is, what your business is doing, and how much resources you're using from the community.
Before we cut you too loose, I just want to make sure everyone is aware there is an info email at RLD's at the cannabis page of RLD, right? So anybody interested in more questions, they can drop an email at that address. Is that right?
Yeah, Andy, because we're getting hundreds of those. And so really what we're leaning towards is asking folks to sign up for the recent updates, right? So as information comes up, we're adding it to the website so that people can kind of self-serve themselves. I would say that we're trying to answer those emails as quickly as possible, but please look at the FAQs and see if your question has already been answered because somebody else has asked it. But what is really important right now is those advisory board member applications are available on our website and will continue to be available through May 3rd. Now's the time to apply. We've got 58 applicants as of this morning and probably adding them as the days go by. So please, if you're interested in that, now is the time to sign up.
Real quick on that point, besides not being an existing medical cannabis producer in the medical cannabis, I guess, industry, is there a type of person that would fit this position?
Yeah, there is. And if you go on to if you're interested in it, I encourage you to go on there, and we have a list of the types of positions that are available. So look through the list, and they're pretty self-explanatory. If you feel like you fit into one of those areas, you just click that button and you submit. There's a space where you can tell us why you would like to be on the board. There's a button that you can submit a resume, a cover letter. So all of that information is available on that link.
What will the advisory board do? I make sure people understand that.
Yeah, the advisory board is going to be meeting pretty regularly at first because they have to help us create those best practice policies for reaching out to the community and for ensuring that there's diversity of licensure and opportunity for employment and business ownership. They'll be helping us with that, but they also have a responsibility to look at and advise us about the rules. And so, the law really says that they don't have to be there until September 1, but we also have to start licensing on September 1. So we need that advisory board now, and it'll be a pretty significant commitment in the beginning. As we kind of stabilize, it'll probably, within a year, I would say we'll probably be meeting on a quarterly basis. But right now, it's going to be a pretty substantive commitment.
I had a quick question for Kim. The idea of impairment came up a lot around the debate around these bills. What can you tell us about what that looks like in terms of setting levels, penalties?
Sure. I mean, the short answer is nothing changed. DUI for impairment from THC was a crime before, and it continues to be a crime, and that is unaffected. We see cases where it is prosecuted all the time. Frankly, it's often prosecuted in conjunction with alcohol. It's pretty common for people to have both substances in their system at the same time. And law enforcement has experts that are trained in identifying signs of impairment from THC. They can testify to a jury and say, when I see these things, I know based on my training that that means that someone is impaired. And even though you mentioned, levels, everyone's familiar with the 0.08 for alcohol. There's evidence to support the idea that at least most people at that point are probably not safe to drive. There is no similar consensus for THC levels, in part because people's tolerance levels seem to have a really significant effect on how impaired they are by certain quantities. And because it can be difficult to distinguish between active THC in someone's blood system and metabolites from last week. Mm-hmm. And so it's just really hard to rely on that exclusively, but that doesn't mean that it's not usable. Prosecutors also can point to evidence in someone's system through blood tests. They just need to bring in an expert to explain what that means in this particular case. And that's how it's always been, and that's how it'll continue to be.
Andy, I know we're right up against 2:00.
No, yeah, we need to cut the superintendent loose.
I have another 2:00 meeting that are already tagging me to sign into.
Okay.
So thank you so much for this opportunity to just answer questions, and I look forward to answering more questions in the future.
Thank you for joining us.
Bye-bye.
I really appreciate it. This was Growing Forward, a collaboration between New Mexico Political Report and New Mexico PBS. You can find other episodes by searching for Growing Forward wherever you normally find your podcasts. And please leave us a rating so we know how we're doing. And special thanks to our producers, Kevin McDonald and Bryce Dix. Our theme music is by Christian Bjorklund. Our logo was created by Catherine Connolly. And thank you, Kim, so much for taking time as well to join us and answer people's questions.